From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project is underway. It's an opportunity for a half hour of what we like to think of as commentary, analysis, and if we're lucky, even some insight into the media issues of the week. I'm Rex Smith, the editor of the Times Union, here with Ira Fussfeld, the longtime publisher of the Daily Freeman of Kingston and affiliated publications.
Good day. Hello,
sir.
Rex.
Great.
Hello,
to see
Alan.
You. Absolutely. And Alan Chartok is here.
In the house.
In person. Dr. Alan Chartok is the CEO of Northeast Public Radio, columnist, commentator, et cetera, et cetera.
I loved, Rex, when you introduced the whole thing and you always say, we like to think of as.
Oh, we like to think of.
We like to think of.
Might get some.
Does anybody else like to think of it that
might
way?
Get some insight. Yeah. That's what we're liking to think, that there might be some insight. You know, you never can tell. Actually, we had a very happy listener who wrote because we had used his email and it became a topic for the show. In fact, an entire topic for the show. And this guy who signs his letter J.D. MBA, as in he's got a law degree and an MBA, says, I only just realized that Alan is a former Rutgers professor. As a three-time Rutgers alumnus, says this guy, JD MBA, I am contractually obligated to take his side now in all arguments, no matter how factually or morally wrong his position is.
Talk about a two-handed slam.
Very good. That's anyway, great. And he had an interesting commentary. People just kind of like to know a little bit of something about the television personalities. Anderson Cooper, who has risen to become star of CNN, of course, he said he was exposed to Anderson Cooper in high school when he forged press credentials, became an unauthorized embedded reporter in Iraq during the first war in the Gulf, and then sold the footage to Channel One school television. His work literally made me care about journalism for the first time in my life, and almost every time I saw him for the next 4 years, he was dodging bullets or hurricane debris. It was phenomenal.
Was that commendatory, do you think, that letter, or not?
He is meaning to be commendatory, yes. He says, without his reporting like his, many of us would never have known or cared about the most horrific events around the world. And, you know, one of the things that Anderson Cooper brings that was never the case in the old days of television anchors is an emotional presence, right? He's a guy who has shed a tear on camera. He has shown his emotion. He has more open about his personal life than most anchors. It is a phenomenon that we're seeing a lot more of in television, and viewers seem to like it.
You think it's good or bad?
Well, you know, Alan has always said that we should know more about journalists' biases. So I think that that means that there's a transparency that helps us to understand each other. It's a double-edged sword because at the same time, you get Chris Cuomo on camera showing off his guns. I'm talking about his arms, not his weaponry. And we kind of, you know, wonder about that. But
I find it distracting. I just want somebody to stand up and tell me the news and not bring his or her personal background into the story. I think that most of these professionals are able to look past their personal biases, but, you know, folks like Alan will say you need to be more transparent and you need to know. And also, I'm guessing, I don't want to put words in your mouth, that you don't necessarily agree that they're putting aside their biases.
Well, I think it's very hard to put aside one's biases. I have on this program probably three times or two times, so this means the last time I can possibly say it. There once was a judge named Jerome Frank.
There once was a judge named Jerome who sought to bring justice at home. Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
So there was this Justice Jerome Frank. He's very famous. He wrote a very important book in which he said every single judge should be psychoanalyzed before they're allowed on the bench, so we would know what their inherent prejudices are. If you could do it with judges, you better believe that reporters bring with them a good deal of their persona about who they are. So if you're gay, if you're lesbian, if you are straight, if you are evangelical, you may have a part of your persona that the public ought to know about so that they can judge what the quality of your reporting is.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You know, in that regard, we have two letters about the Second Amendment, and one of them takes aim at the notion that most of us in journalism, he thinks, come at the Second Amendment with a bias against guns and believes that that is a routine part of our reporting, who said that if the conversation started with acknowledging the role of the rifle, get this, as the great equalizer between rich and poor, the government and the people, and our final line of defense against tyrants, and then pivoted to how to preserve that in a time when people are abusing that freedom, like monitoring gun sales. This is a Second Amendment advocate who says you probably wouldn't get the quantity of hate mail and the volume that you do.
First of all, we don't get a lot of hate mail.
Yeah.
We get only an occasional piece from somebody like that. And one of the reasons we read it is we think it's very important, right, Rex?
Mm-hmm.
So that everybody has their say in all of this. But polls in the United States show that the people, not the NRA, not the gun manufacturers, not the bought and paid for congresspeople. I don't know if you've been at the Times lately, but the Times has a list, I think yesterday, of the people who got the most money. And some of these senators are getting over $1 million in campaign contributions from these folks.
From the gun industry.
From the gun industry, mm-hmm. Yeah. It's extraordinary amount of money. But the American people know it's time. And I know that because I've been reading reports in the press, and this is a program about the press now, that suggests that Speaker Ryan, for example, has taken off one of the most onerous pieces of legislation that we ever saw, which is making silencers easier to come by. The proponents, maybe the proponent who wrote the letter, is saying that the reason it's important to have silencers is it's easier on our ears. We don't hurt our ears, we gunsmen, to do that. But no, I mean, I think he's wrong. I think we don't get a lot of, number one, we don't get a lot of mail on this. In fact, very little. And number two, the polls are all showing the American people think it's time for sensible gun regulation.
We're in a very difficult time in this country. To bring this back to the press media issue, if people decide, correctly or not, that the reporters have a bias, that they are anti-gun or pro-gun, often without any evidence to that, they're simply not going to believe or they're not going to trust what these reporters have to say. And on the one hand, I mean, Rex talks all the time about news literacy and people should be careful about what they read and what they believe is to be true. But on the other hand, there is a point where, you know, a Trump can come out and throw around the term fake news and people are willing to accept it because they'll say, well, they're a liberal, they're anti-gun, and so their reporting can't be accurate. I don't know how to get the genie back in the bottle.
Well, Ira, I don't agree with you. Obviously, I think that the genie is not in the bottle for good reason. I think this is garbage. We just saw all of these people basically wiped out, 500 people maimed and hurt in one of the worst travesties that we have ever seen in this country. And I think that that because there's been accurate news reporting about this, we're about to see a change in the way it, you remember that you have over 300 million guns in the United
States. But that
States.
Accurate news coverage, according to you, but not necessarily according to those who are pro-gun.
That's right, Ira, to which I say, tough darts.
Well,
this is just the way it is.
Well, then you have 50% or more or less, depending on the margin, who simply are not going to believe what they hear on TV.
I don't think it's anything like 50%.
You know, we have a separate email from a listener who says that we are making a mistake as journalists by repeating the lie, quote, that the Second Amendment has anything to do with the right of an individual to own a gun. Please do not repeat this lie. The Second Amendment had nothing to do with individual right to own a gun until the hypocritical and corrupt Heller Supreme Court decision created that right out of thin air and says, break the cycle, speak the truth, do not repeat the lie. The Second Amendment doesn't speak of individual rights to own guns.
So the last thing we want to do is report on what the Supreme Court of the United States said in Heller.
Yeah.
Obviously, in my opinion, they made a terrible error. Nevertheless, you've got to report on it. You've got to say they said it. And as one wag once put it on the Supreme Court, The Constitution is what we say it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was established in Marbury v. Madison, so we can't really change that. We should talk about the coverage of the Las Vegas massacre. For many of us, the approach to it became a local story because so many people were shot and so many people were there from all over. Local newspapers, radio, TV stations everywhere had local people who they could talk to, and that gives us an entree to the story that we might not otherwise have. It personalizes it for readers. You know, we sometimes make fun of that kind of reporting. I remember when I was a reporter on Long Island for the newspaper Newsday, and there was a fire at a resort hotel in the Caribbean, and the headline of the story in Newsday was Long Islanders Escape Fire in Caribbean.
And in Albany, the same story, because we had, as I remember it, a prominent politician in the hotel who jumped out and got away from it. So that became the Albany story.
Right, right. But it does give you a way for people to grasp it. If they think that their neighbor or somebody who's kind of like their neighbor is a part of a story, it makes it more personal for them. So this story had a little bit of something for everyone. It was a local story everywhere, really.
Well, it's not only those factors, but so many people have been to Las Vegas, and everybody has been to a hotel, and many people have been to outdoor concerts. I mean, there are any number of entrees into the story to make it relevant for anywhere people might read or hear about it. I always ask the question, and I'm the old man get off my lawn, regarding how much coverage is too much coverage.
I'm with you, man. I can't turn that damn CNN on without turning it off these days, because I know this terrible thing happened. I want to know what the president is doing and whether or not the Mueller investigation is proceeding and whether or not our Constitution has been put in jeopardy by the Russians. I don't want to see a half an hour solid piece because I know these poor people have been murdered. I just don't understand why it's necessary.
Well, if only if it was a half an hour. I mean, the day after, it was wall to wall. No Russia coverage, no Puerto Rico coverage. All of the anchors go out there. I mean, if there is a major story, Rex, are you going to leave your desk to be the anchor at the site of the major story? No, you're going to be sending your people out, and you're going to be coordinating it at the desk. Why do the network news anchors feel it's necessary to be standing there in front of the building with the two broken windows?
They don't feel it's that. Showbiz. They're told that.
It's showbiz entirely. It's entirely for ratings, because readers, viewers love it. Viewers love to think that their anchor is on the scene, that this person is not just tied to a studio reading a teleprompter. And so it's become the norm now. These anchors have to go to where the things are. And the problem with television news, where even in the era of cable and of specialized channels, is it's a serial medium. You can only do one thing at a time. And so you have to sit there and watch what they program for you, as opposed to a newspaper where you can turn the page and go on to the next thing. This is a little difficult. Yeah. So it's too bad they do that. But I agree with you. I don't see why it is that we can't take time to do more than one story at a time
in television. Apparently what the news directors do is hold their fingers up in the wind and see which way the wind is blowing and make an assessment of what it will take to keep their jobs and how CNN can beat MSNBC and how MSNBC can beat CNN. And that, to me, is the whole ballgame. It's baseball, folks.
Except it's more scientific than that, as baseball is more scientific these days. You know, we get real-time metrics on what people are reading on TimesUnion.com in my newsroom. And everybody does in television as well. You know what is drawing people's attention. And so what gets their attention is what they go with.
Yes, Rex. Not to start a fight with you, of course. But let me just say this. You know full well that if you put some new, for example, columnist in your paper, you'd get more hits. But you know that it's not a good idea. You also know that if you put certain things on the front page, and that's very interesting about the Times Union, you'll get more hits. And you don't. You put it on page 2 and page 3. I have great respect for that.
Thank you. I see what you're saying.
You need to know who your audience is. I mean, I've used the example that the company that I used to work for owned a number of newspapers around the country, and they weren't all the same. And so in Trenton, New Jersey, where they owned the Trentonian, a tabloid, much like the New York Post is a tabloid, they would run a picture on page 3 every day of a scantily clad woman.
Yes.
Now, they probably sold some papers as a result of that, because they felt that was right for their audience. But I wouldn't do that in my newspaper in Kingston, because whereas it might have attracted somebody who wasn't buying the paper before, it more than likely would have created a loss of scores of readers who wouldn't want that in their newspaper.
You mean they immediately would have left because there was a scantily clad woman.
Oh, yes.
Or do you think
Kingston or Troy, I was an editor of a paper of the same company at that time, and I think it wouldn't have worked in our market either. Yeah.
Well, when you say wouldn't have worked, I'm fascinated by that.
Yeah.
Because I think that men and women are filled with equal parts of, you know, good and not so good. And I think that there are some who will, for example, let me give you an example. This congressman got caught today. Murphy, his name is.
Yes.
Yeah. He got caught. He's been anti-abortion every single day, and he voted for the 20-week abortion thing in the United States Congress. And now it turns out, at least according to published press reports, that what happened was that he recommended to his girlfriend that she have an abortion. He quit the Congress because of it. What a hypocrite. And I'm asking you a question right now.
Do you mean to see
Donald Trump, who was always talking about grabbing women by the genitals and the rest, and having all of these conquests in his so-called conquests in his life, you're telling me that there's never been the A word mentioned in all of that?
What's the A word?
Abortion.
Oh,
I missed the point of the...
Of the what?
Of the media. Where were we going here?
Well, I'll tell you where I'm going, Rex.
Okay.
It's very important for everybody to understand that what the press reports becomes reality.
Uh-huh.
In the case of Congressman Murphy, this report led the news this morning.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a study in hypocrisy. And that's what the role of the press is so often, right?
So often it is important.
And that's what I meant when we had to get to the press issue.
Aha. Uh-huh.
But to where my original point was, there are certain markets and certain newspapers where publishing that kind of picture in a feisty tabloid works, and it's typical of that genre. Whereas in the most community newspapers, and I would include the Times Union, which is larger than a community newspaper, that's not the kind of picture that will work. It will offend the sensibilities of most of your readers.
But you might get more people reading that paper
briefly
if you were doing that.
Yeah, for a little while. It doesn't work. Ultimately, your basis of sale is credibility, and that harms the credibility of the product. And in fact, that even happened at the Trentonian. For a while, it was the fastest growing newspaper in New Jersey, they used to say on the cover, and then it stopped being that, and people stopped buying it. And I think that is partly because they hurt their credibility. That poor photographer, that guy had won a Pulitzer Prize for photography, and his assignment then was to take photographs of 19-year-old women in bathing suits and motel swimming pools. It was a sad thing.
The Trentonian, there's that line, even with feisty tabloids, that there was a fire at a mental health facility in Trenton. And the headline in the Trentonian the next morning was... And I apologize, it's their headline, not mine, Roasted Nuts.
Oh my, wow. Okay, that's terrible. So the editor who wrote that, I hope we had some...
I have a feeling the big boss at the time loved it.
I don't know that I think we should have mentioned that on this.
That's
let's not talk
offensive.
About that cartoon in Bennington.
Then. Yeah, there was a terrible cartoon. The Bennington Banner actually has apologized. The president of the Banner and the editor of the group of newspapers has apologized for it.
The Eagle Group?
Yep, a cartoon published showing bodies in Las Vegas. It was a syndicated cartoon from... Cagle Cartoon Syndicate.
Yes.
Yeah.
And what did it show?
Oh, it showed stick figures of bodies lying around, and the caption on the headline was, "Whatever happens in Vegas, ... And
now you say you thought that was a terrible cartoon.
Well, I think that a lot of people took offense. Sometimes there's a time and a place for humor, and this, I think, attempted to attach a little touch of humor to a tragic incident. People weren't ready for humor at this point, I think.
So it comes under the heading of too soon.
Perhaps so.
Yeah. I found for years and years and years that the source of the most complaints at my newspaper were editorial cartoons.
Mm-hmm.
And our editorial cartoonists, many were from Cagle, that news syndicate. They were among the best cartoonists in the country. And the cartoons are very sharp, and they prompt a reaction, as did this one, and it's the old one picture is worth 1,000 words. Now, that having been said, 30 years ago, I would have used that cartoon. 10 years ago, I wouldn't have, because I had become gun-shy. But I didn't think it was a terrible cartoon. The question is the timing of it.
Mm-hmm. Very
It made a point.
By the way, if you're just joining us and you're not sure who all these voices are, that's Ira Fussfeld, a publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman in Kingston, New York. Alan Shartok is here, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio, and I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union in Albany. We need to talk about an interesting issue here having to do with journalists running for public office. The occasion for this is the announcement by a rather well-known New York political journalist, a guy named Ross Barkan, B-A-R-K-A-N, who has surprisingly announced that he's going to be running for the state Senate as a Democrat in southern Brooklyn against the incumbent Republican, Senator Marty Golden.
And even worse, even if he wins, he's going to keep doing his job.
Yeah, he says he's going to continue to write about it. Now, this is a guy who used to work for the New York Observer when it was owned by the president's son-in-law. Interesting. And he quit, as a matter of fact, at that time because he was motivated, he says, by the decision of the paper to endorse Trump for president. Of course, the publisher at the time was
his son-in-law,
Jared Kushner. So the question is it appropriate for a journalist ever to run for public office?
Well, I have to tell my story. I'm sorry, I know you guys know it, but when I first went to work for Channel 6 as a political observer, the boss called me in and he said, okay, I'm giving you your chance, but you have to promise me right now you'll never run for political office. I said, done. Although I did run for selectman in Alford, Massachusetts, but it was a very small little tiny job. In any case, it was all cleared. And then a guy comes along who, of your knowledge, Rex, who puts a headline on the paper, on his paper, I believe it was in Troy, New York, that gave five people who might be the head of the Public Service Commission, of which I knew little. And the fifth guy was me, and the news director called me in and screamed at me. And he said, you lied to me. You told me you weren't going to ever get involved in politics. Now you're doing it. The credibility of all of us is at stake. You're doing it. I said, Don, I don't even know what the Public Service Commission does. So he called up the reporter, and the reporter fessed up. He said, yeah, it was all a joke.
Oh,
and
boy.
I never heard anybody that angry in my entire life.
I would hope so.
Nor did I get an apology.
Offense all around in that case.
So do you feel that, of course, you had promised your boss you weren't going to do it, but had that conversation not taken place, you were a commentator on their air. This guy is a columnist in his newspaper, who both of whom are paid to give opinions. Does that not allow them some leeway to become a politician when you understand that the only thing they're going to do in the newspaper or on the air is give opinions, and it's identified?
What do you think, Rex?
I'm not advocating. I'm curious.
He's an opinion analyst. Lately, he's been writing mostly for the Village Voice, reported opinion pieces, this guy, Ross Barkan. I think you give up being a journalist when you run for public office, because even if you are writing opinion pieces, there's a sensibility that what you read in that publication is something that is reported out, and that the facts are at least straight. And in politics, I think you should give up your platform. It's terrible for the press when somebody who is a former journalist becomes a candidate, because then questions are raised retroactively about the coverage that has been there before.
I don't even mind former that much, but current is a whole different idea. The most trouble I've ever gotten into as a columnist is we sold our little house in Alford, Massachusetts, and I wrote a column called How to Sell Your House Without an Agent.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
It was hell to pay.
I'm sure there was. Yeah. I do think that's true, that you need to keep your personal experiences like that out of your work, even as a journalist. You know, sometimes I feel as though, you know, I get bad service or something somewhere at a car dealership, and I would love to just be able to fire away in my column and take issue. You can't do that. You have a responsibility to not use your job as a journalist to advance your personal agenda. And I think that's what this guy is doing.
And yet, when you walk into that place to the service manager, they know who you are, Rex.
Well, that's Mo Green from The Godfather. Do you know who I am?
Do you know who I am? Only because I'm on WAMC, right?
Absolutely.
So that's it. We're through with the media project for this week. Ira Fussfeld, Alan Shartok, and Rex Smith, we are grateful to you for joining us and hope you will again next week. Thanks for being here for the media project.
And thanks for your service, Rex.
But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people.
When they know the Media Project is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Alan Chartok is CEO of WAMC, Professor Emeritus at the State University of New York, commentator, columnist, and author. Rex Smith is editor of the Times Union. And Ira Fussfeld is the publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman. You can listen to or podcast The Media Project anytime at WAMC.org or just download the WAMC app for your iPhone or Android at the Play Store today. Thanks for listening.
To represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give three cheers for freedom of the press.